In the year 42 A.D., turn the lights down, Claudius, emperor of the Romans, issued a fateful decree to destroy Christian Britain, man, woman, and child, its great institutions, and burn its libraries. In this edict, Claudius proclaimed in the Roman Senate that acceptance of the Christian faith was a capital offense, punishable by death via the sword, the torture chamber, or to be cast to the devouring lions in the arena of the Colosseum. It is interesting to note that this ruling also included any person descended from David. This meant the Jew, making no exceptions as to whether he be a converted Jew or one holding to the Orthodox Jewish faith, as the Romans viewed it. Why? Why this remote wilderness area, the target of genocide, an extermination of the Christian faith? Well, Christianity, as traditional history tells us, threatened the Roman Empire on the east. But as we were reviewing the other night and recounting the history of the British Church, founded by Joseph of Arimathea, who converted the Silurian king's household, it had taken root in the Silurian kingship, established the first Christian nation, and at Glastonbury, the first church above ground. Now, the Romans had not previously held any enmity special to the British. Actually, and perhaps grudgingly, they held the Briton in respect. Association in commerce and culture had drawn them together for centuries. I'm reading from The Drama of the Lost Disciples by George F. Jowett. The threat was this Christian nation under the Silurian kings, so oft left out of any church history, that threatened the worship of the emperor. And the overwhelming rise of Christianity in populous Britain and Gaul, south of France, was viewed with grave consternation in Rome. Britain was the seeding ground where an ever-flowing stream of neophytes were tutored and converted by apostles and disciples of Christ and sent out to other lands to teach the gospel. The Christian message had taken root in the king's house. And it was from Britain that apostles and missionaries were going to evangelize other sections of the empire, and from south of France. The decree of Claudius was inspired by fear and with sadistic intentions. And they felt that violent persecutors would terrify Britain into submission. How wrongly they judged their opponents, they were soon to learn. This persecution was not confined to a short period. It endured from the time of the Claudian invasion with intermittent waves, AD 42, to the close of the horrible and infamous Diocletian savagery of AD 320, nearly 300 years. Which testifies to the resistance. From this Claudian edict to the Diocletian persecution, in intermittent waves, extermination of Britain and all that was Christian was a Roman obsession. The commander-in-chief selected by the Emperor Claudius to carry out his edict was none other than the famous Aulus Plautius, called the Scipio of his day. He stands in Roman history as one of the most brilliant commanders and conquerors in her military record. He arrived in the area of Britain we now know as England, AD 43, making his headquarters at Chichester. Plautius lost no time in sending his veteran legions into action, directing his campaign to the south against the Silurians, thus cutting off the powerful Brigantes of the remote north who were the Yorkshire Celts. Both armies clashed with appalling violence. And in this first conflict, the Romans, probably underestimating the quality of their opponents, famed Roman legionaries were forced to retreat. In the various battles that followed, to his surprise, the Roman general realized he was confronted with a military intelligence that matched his own and an army of warriors, though greatly outnumbered, who were undaunted and fought back with a fearless ferocity which had never before been encountered by the veteran soldiery of Rome. At the onset, the British Silurian army was led by Guiderius, the elder brother of Arviragus, who was second in command. Guiderius had succeeded his father to the kingdom of the Silures. Arviragus, as prince, ruled over his dukedom of Cornwall. In the second battle with the Romans, Guiderius was killed in action. Arviragus succeeded his slain brother in command of the army into the kingdom of the Silures. At this time, the second branch of the Silurian kingdom, lying farther south than what now is Wales, had not entered the conflict. Caradoc, king of the Welsh Silures, was first cousin to Arviragus, a much older man and an experienced military leader. A few years before this record, his father, known as the Good King Bran, had abdicated his throne voluntarily in favor of his son Caradoc. Bran was a deeply religious person and had resigned his kingship to become Archdruid of Siluria, He and his family had accepted the new faith, and some of the members of the family had already been converted and baptized by Joseph of Arimathea. But Brian and Caradoc had not received this final act of conversion. Now, as the conflict between Roman and Britain increased in vigor and territorial scope, Caradoc realized the seriousness of the situation, particularly since the death of his cousin, Guiderius. It was agreed that a more concerted and determined military action was needed against the Romans. Arviragus, by necessity, was only substituting in command for his slain brother. It was law among the British that the supreme leader of the army, especially when more than one clan was involved, could only be appointed by general acclamation of the people. The military council and the archdruids. The election of such a command was known by the official title of Pendragon, meaning commander-in-chief. By popular election, Caradoc, better known in history by the name the Romans gave him, Caractacus, was created Pendragon or Pendragon. Caractacus, as we shall now call him, was a man of great vigor, intelligent, versed in the arts of politics and warfare. As is to be expected, being raised in a religious household, he had deep religious convictions. He received his education chiefly in the British schools and partly at Rome. He was an able administrator of noble mien and outstanding stature. His countenance was described by Roman writers of the day as bold and honorable. Such was the man who was elected Pendragon to conduct the war against the invading Romans. He began the continuation of the strife with all his natural energy. Out of this bitter conflict, his outstanding military genius and invincible courage carved for him an immortal name in history that was never to perish in British and Roman annals. In them, he stands out as one of the greatest examples of all that is grand and noble. Feared by the foe, it is said that Roman mothers used his name to quiet their children. His military merit won the unstinted admiration of the enemy, who named him the Scourge of the Romans. Historically, his achievements are well known, but not so well the reasons for them. Modern historians, in dealing with the Roman invasions, completely ignore the reason for the great Roman invasion of Britain. Never once did they mention the Edict of Claudius or explain that it was a war of religious extermination designed to crush Christianity at its source. Evidently, they were totally ignorant of the true reason, and they could have easily been enlightened by reading the Roman records of that time. Traditional historians write off 9 years of ceaseless warfare between Roman and Britain, led by Caractacus and Arviragus as the greatest Roman generals, or rather against the greatest Roman generals, as though it was of no significance. They give the impression that the British armies were driven like wild sheep before the Roman legions. Why not? The historians borrow primarily from official histories written during the time of the Roman Empire and the Holy Roman Empire, which are designed to eulogize and paint a better picture of Rome. Britain was the Vietnam of the Roman Empire. Surely it takes but little imagination from even a casual perusal of this 9-year campaign to realize that it would not take 9 years for the Roman Empire, with all of its power and magnitude, to subdue opponents who were merely wild-painted barbarians, as they were pictured, but which they weren't. By this time, Britain, or rather Rome, had conquered all the world except Britain. They had defeated mighty armies, skilled in warfare, and led by brilliant kings and generals. The conquered nations they had enslaved in Africa, Asia, and Europe testified of their despotic brutality. They could tread with iron feet Alexandria, Caesarea, Antioch, Constantinople, Jerusalem. The so-called power centers of Christianity, totally under the heel of Rome. The same Roman generals who had accomplished these conquests led the Roman army into Britain to stamp out the earliest church founded there within 5 years of the resurrection of Christ. And those Roman armies failed, one after another. With such a far-flung empire to protect, the Roman emperors could not afford to keep their greatest army and best commanders in Britain for 9 years, unless there was a cause that impassioned them. They couldn't afford the decimation of their veteran legions in useless combat. The enormous loss of lives on both sides sustained in many battles in Britain, according to the records, were larger than the loss in most of the battles in World War I and World War II. This does not indicate leisurely campaigns to just train soldiers in Britain. In some of the battles, several of the greatest Roman generals were engaged in conducting battle strategy at the one time. This was an experience never before called for of Roman generalship. Common sense shows there could only be one reason for this long conflict. And the Romans had met their match in military genius and in man-to-man combat. They faced a warrior ferocity that outmatched their own tough veterans. The fierce, fearless spirit of the British soldiery appalled the Romans. Their bravery and disdain of death shocked them. The great Agricola, engaged in the British campaign, stated that it would be no disgrace if he fell in battle among so brave a people. This had to be more than a defense of the shores, which could have readily ended by coming to terms with the Romans. It was a battle against extermination. It was on these fields of battle that the symbol of the cross of Christ, adopted by Christian Silurian leaders, was unfurled as given to Arviragus by St. Joseph so all nations could see for the first time in military history. This alone proclaimed what the British were fighting for, defense of their new faith, Christianity, the gospel of Jesus, with the freedom it gave to all who believed in him. Caractacus is given official credit as being the first general to lead a Christian army in battle in defense of the faith. as Pendragon of the British, elected by them in open council, this is true. But it was Guiderius and Arviragus who led the first battle against the Romans, and it was they who first stopped Aulus Plautius in his tracks. Guiderius was the first British king to fall in this battle. And before Caractacus was elected, Pendragon, the British battalions had marched towards the foe, flying the coat of arms bequeathed to Arviragus by Joseph of Arimathea on their battle standards and painted on their war shields. And this long before St. George was born. Throughout the entire campaign, Arviragus fought as the right-hand man of the Pendragon, Caractacus. And for years after, when Caractacus no longer led the British forces against the plundering Romans, Arviragus conducted the conflict. Though the Romans destroyed every altar in their path, not once were they able to pierce through to their objective, the Isle of Avalon, the sanctuary of Christendom, where the first mission by St. Joseph of Arimathea planted the flag of Christianity. And St. Joseph and his Bethany companions were never molested, nor was their shrine ever violated by Roman intrusion. I warn you, no better picture can be obtained of the relentless manner in which this war was fought, with victories swinging from one side to the other, than by reading the reports of the foremost Roman writers, Tacitus, Martial, Juvenal, and others. The story chronicled by the pens of the enemy writers gives more substance to the truth than if it were written by the Silurians themselves. With ungrudging admiration, they tell how the Silurian warriors led by Caractacus, Arviragus, and the arch-druid priests swept onward in irresistible waves over the bodies of their dead. Over the bodies of dying comrades with a battling savagery that appalled the hardened, war-scarred veterans of the Roman legions. Now, when the Druids are named, an immediate, traditional gasp of horror to associate them with Christians. Perhaps the most misrepresented religious people in history are the Druids. They expected a Messiah. They had a name that made them immediately embrace Jesus as he was preached. The fierce outcries of these British warriors rang over the din and clash of sword and shield. And for the first time, the Romans met women warriors fighting side by side with their men in combat. And I read you once the reaction of some who came under attack of Celtic women in battle. Tacitus states that their long flowing flaxen hair and blazing blue eyes were a terrifying sight to behold. And for the first time, the Roman soldiery heard the amazing motto of the ancient Druidic priesthood transferred into a clarion Christian battle cry, the truth against the world. No finer battle cry was ever employed with equal meaning, and it's never died. It has lived through the ages, and today it's the motto of the Druidical order in Wales. The British stood alone against the world, fought alone, died alone, in the name of their new faith and accepted Savior Jesus Christ. This is maybe the least told story of Christian history, suppressed by those who wanted to make Rome dominate. Tacitus, the Roman historian, writing of the Claudian campaign that lasted for 9 years, except for one brief 6 months pause, dismally wrote that although Rome hurled at the British the greatest army in her history, it failed to prevail against the military genius of Caractacus and the reckless fierceness of the British warrior. Many drawn battles were fought, and the famed legions of Rome frequently suffered defeat with terrible slaughter. On occasions when the British suffered severe reverses, Tacitus said, the fierce ardor of the British increased. After 2 years of ceaseless warfare, Claudius, recognizing the futility of the struggle and the terrible drainage on his finest legions, took advantage of a reverse against Caractacus at Brandon Camp, A.D. 45, to seek peace through an armistice. A six-month truce was declared in which Caractacus and Arviragus were invited to Rome to discuss the possibilities for peace. The facts that followed prove that Claudius went to great lengths to come to satisfactory terms with the obstinate British leaders. Hoping to clinch the peace, the Emperor Claudius offered to Arviragus in marriage his daughter Venus Julia. And amazing as it appears, they were married in Rome during the truce period, A.D. 45. And interestingly enough, Venus Julia, named after Venus, mother of Aeneas of the Julian family, was of Trojan stock. Now here we have the strange instance of a Christian British king becoming the son-in-law of the pagan Roman Emperor Claudius, who had sworn to exterminate Christianity and Britain. Now, one is justified in asking, would the emperor of a nation, then the most powerful in the world, high in culture and intellectual pursuits, have sacrificed his natural daughter in marriage to the wife of a crude barbarian? I doubt it. There had to be some other valid reason, and as we shall see, as time moves on, the unseen hand of God was writing the script. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
On the phone. Quickly. I'm reading from The Drama of the Lost Disciples by George F. Jowett. This marriage, in which the Emperor Claudius, during a truce period, in the attempt to make peace, having failed in his edict and efforts to crush Britain, giving his daughter in marriage to Arviragus, was but the beginning of other similar strange circumstances that were to swiftly arise. And these circumstances were to have a tremendous influence on the Christian movement in Rome, with the British dominating the entire scene, contrary to what history reshaped by the Catholic Middle Ages and passed on by rote would have us believe. For sheer drama, these incidents have no equal in the pages of history. During the 6 months' truce, while Caractacus and Arviragus were at Rome discussing peace terms, when Arviragus was getting married, Aulus Plautius, the Roman commander, remained in Britain maintaining the truce on behalf of Rome. Very interesting. I'm not convinced you want me to continue. I can read without reading aloud. Now, you get on the telephone, I could be persuaded. Now, to understand the role of the British in the formation of the Roman Church, you need to remember there are two ladies named Gladys. One is the sister of Caractacus, and then the other is the daughter of Caractacus. Not unusual for daughters to be named after an aunt, and even more important when you understand that Gladys is Celtic for princess. And we need to distinguish these two Gladys in their role in the Roman Church. During the 6-month truce, I'm reading from the Drama of the Lost Disciples by George F. Jowett. While Caractacus and Arviragus were at Rome discussing peace terms, and Arviragus was getting married to the daughter of the Roman emperor, Aulus Plautius, the Roman commander, remained in Britain, maintaining the truce on behalf of Rome. During this interval, another strange alliance took place in Britain. Gladys, Celtic for princess, sister of the British warlord Caractacus, was united in marriage to the Roman commander-in-chief, Aulus Plautius. So now Arviragus, the right-hand man of the Pendragon, Caractacus, warlord of the British clans, Silurian king of the Wales branch. Arviragus is wed to a daughter of the Roman Emperor Claudius, and the Roman commander-in-chief, Aulus Plautius, is wed to the sister of Caractacus of the Silurian house. Again, the amazing spectacle of a member of the Silurian royal family and a Christian married to a Roman pagan. Now, I want to tell you, the world would have the church today only go down and take care of the poor that the world has made poor. That is not the way the Church of Jesus Christ established itself. The power of the Silurian kingly family was won over, and from that power position, Christianity spread through this nation. Now, the devil has had a lot of experience with seeing how much he loses when Christianity moves into the power center. And as the day of Antichrist approaches, you better be sure that the spirit of Antichrist, under the influence of the dragon, which is Satan, is going to seek to cripple the power of the church. And we're seeing it everywhere. Gladys had been personally converted by Joseph of Arimathea. Together with her niece, Euergane, Guiderius, the first king to fall in the battle, Arviragus, and other members of the British aristocracy. Like her father, the ex-king and present archdruid, she was devoutly religious, completing her religious instruction at Avalon in association with the Bethany women who had come up there to spend time with Joseph of Arimathea. though maintaining their contacts in the south of France. Even more dramatic, her brother and husband were wartime opponents. But now a truce was in effect. The marriage of Gladius and Plutius is brought into the Roman limelight by the heathen historian Tacitus in his Annals, 1332, wherein he relates with humor the peculiar circumstances and results of a Roman trial in which Gladys, the wife of Plutius, is accused of being Christian. On her marriage, Gladys took the name of Pomponia, according to Roman custom, which was the name of the Plutian clan. Later the name Graecina was added so that she is thereafter known as Pomponia Graecina Plautius. The added name was a distinctive academic honor conferred upon her in recognition of her extraordinary scholarship in Greek. As we shall see, the truce fell through, and hostilities were resumed between the British and Romans. Following the marriage of the Roman commander Aulus Plautius to the British princess, it appears as though the Emperor Claudius distrusted leaving further operation of the war in Britain to Plautius, so he was recalled to Rome in AD 47, though honorably relieved of his command. Reference to these events and the trial of Gladys is well covered by Tacitus, the Latin historian, as will be noted from the following quoted text out of Tacitus. Pomponia Graecina was a woman of illustrious birth and the wife of Plautius, who on his return from Britain, I'm quoting, entered the city with the pomp of an ovation and was accused of embracing the rites of a foreign superstition. The matter of this charge against Pomponia, otherwise known as Gladius, the matter was referred to the jurisdiction of her husband. Convenient. Plautius, in conformity to ancient usage, called together a number of her relations, and in her presence sat in judgment on the conduct of his wife and the accusations against her. He pronounced her innocent. End quote. It was the custom of Roman law to give priority to the nobility to judge and settle any legal disputation where the family was concerned. Consequently, it was an order for Plautius to judge his wife. And Pomponia is judged in the presence of her own relations, all immediate members of the royal Silurian Christian household, undoubtedly acting in her defense. It is quite certain that not much defense was needed. Plautius knew his wife Gladys was a Christian before he married her, as were all the immediate members of her family as well as her royal relatives. The fact that they were married in Britain makes it certain that the bond of holy matrimony was sealed by the priesthood of her Christian faith. And evidently, Plautius had a sympathetic leaning to the new faith, for we're later informed that he also became a Christian. The Reverend C.C. Dobson, a keen student of Celtic Roman history in his works, goes into much detail covering this whole situation, pointing out that Tacitus refers to Pomponia as a woman of illustrious birth, an aristocrat. Her marriage to the Roman nobleman bears this out, that she was unusually talented as well as highly cultured is borne out by the honor of her Roman conferred title, Graecina, an academic title is said for her mastery of the Greek language. And yet we've been told they were all barbarians. The Reverend Dobson writes, quote, "For 40 years she was a leader of the best Roman society. A brilliant woman of wide cultural learning, she was a past scholar in classical literature and wrote a number of books of prose and poetry in Greek and Latin, as well as in her native language, Kimric. Their home was a meeting place for the talented, and they were to be intimately associated with the apostles Peter and Paul, as Gladys had been with Joseph, Lazarus, Mary Magdalene, and the rest of the missionaries at Avalon. The Roman records state that when the Roman general Aulus Plautius was recalled to Rome, A.D. 47, quote, he took his foreign wife with him. Gladys and Plautius remained in Britain almost 18 months after their marriage. The armistice had proved fruitless. The British leaders considered the peace terms unsatisfactory. Caractacus and Arviragus did not linger in Rome, but they ventured to Britain, and with Arviragus went his Roman wife, Venus Julia. All were faced with an unpleasant situation. Plautius, in conducting the war against his in-laws, Caractacus against his sister and brother-in-law, and Arviragus opposing his father-in-law, the Emperor Claudius. What Claudius and the Roman Senate had underestimated was the unbending temper of the Britons. He was quickly to learn that it was an impossibility for the British to make any compromise where the religion was concerned. And as said, Plautius was recalled. Astorius Scapula had replaced Plautius, and the war continued for another 7 years. Finally, after many bloody battles, the British under the Pendragon Caractacus met disaster at Clun through treachery, Shropshire, A.D. 52, by a strange trick of circumstance. Let me tell you about it. You want me to?
Yes, sir.
Go on telephone. Music. This will lead us straight to the church at Rome.